You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, December 13th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Daniel Nakanian, editor-in-chief of Bulge Magazine, on some of the key statewide or local races in the wake of the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. And then Lupe Rodriguez, executive director for the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Justice. Talk about the Institute's ongoing attempts to protect abortion care post-Roe. Also on the program today, Uvalde school shooting video shows the complete ineptitude of good guys with a gun. Meanwhile, evidence shows Trump premeditated the assault on the Capitol. And the January 6th panel claims Trump attempted witness tampering in the past month. As gas prices begin to drop, inflation grew just over 9% in the past year. And while Biden's numbers are in the toilet, the congressional race's numbers are oddly tight. Meanwhile, Manchin's Senate tax deal is clashing with Josh Gottheimer's fat cat caucus in the House. Joe Biden is in the Mideast, seems to be deep-sixing the Iran deal. Twitter sues Elon Musk for breach of contract. And the Sri Lankan president flees as massive protests continue. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. What's going on? Did I say December 13th?
Mm-hmm.
When did I say it?
I just had like an internal battle with myself. Should I say anything about that?
Where did I get December from?
I have no idea. I mean, it's hot as hell in here.
It's about the opposite, yeah.
Yeah.
It's July 13th.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Emma Viglin, for being here. And
you're welcome. Yeah,
well, somebody put it on the IM, and then you had this look on your face like, I don't know if I should tell them. It was a little bit scary to see that look.
Yeah.
In people. Like, I'm not anticipating that look for, well, I was hoping for like another 20 years to get it from my kids. Just like, don't correct dad. It's all right. Doesn't matter, really. As long as he's dressed appropriately, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Can't even say close enough with that one, although you did get the day right.
I don't know where I got December from. I mean, like, I'm usually reading up until the last second, and I don't see December anywhere. I just...
It's okay. It's okay. Would you like your pudding? It's hump day, folks.
I guess if I had said January 13th, that would be further away than December.
It would be, but it would be a little bit more contextual because we're talking about January 6th.
Right. All right. Well, good night, folks. I'm going to take a nap.
Yeah.
And enjoy the show. First off, I guess I'm a little thrown off because I got a couple of corrections to make from yesterday's show. I mean, I don't know if the first one is really a correction. But Emma yesterday was very, very, I thought, too cynical about the potential for a deal to nominate this really odious right-wing judge in Kentucky to the bench. What's his name? Chad Manning?
Meredith.
Chad Meredith. And I said, well, it's possible there's a deal that you put that one judge on, maybe you get 30 others because McConnell would not gum up the works as the way that he's been doing. That could be the deal. And Emma was very sadly, very cynical For someone your age, it's sad to see that.
Hate to see that.
Off air, Sam was like, "Are you hormonal or something?"
No, I did not say that. I would never say that. But you did seem very cynical, and that's sad to see someone, so early in life.
Right. Being,
yeah. Well, it turns out you are absolutely right. Did a little digging. One of the best places to go for something like this is the Revolving Door Project. Jeff Hauser over there and his crew follow this stuff. And it turns out, as you know, there is a blue slip procedure where home state senators can essentially quash the nomination of judges. But it's also the case that they can quash the nomination of U.S. attorneys. There are something like 98 U.S. attorneys, I think it is, in the country. 94 offices, excuse me, led by 93 U.S. attorneys. And there are no U.S. attorneys from Kentucky right now. I think there's, many of these people are still Trump era ones. And during the Trump era, I'm not going to go too deep into this, but Jeff Sessions managed to get around Senate confirmation for these people. Now, it's important to have Senate confirmation because you don't want a bunch of cronies going into this office, political cronies. You need the Senate to confirm them to make sure that they're, you know, somewhat independent. You are allowed if you, and they go in, they fired the U.S. attorneys, then they appointed someone within the office to act as acting U.S. attorney there, and you can keep those people in place for 300 days. And then you can appoint an interim one for 120 days. And there's some question as to what you do after that, but then they appointed another interim one for another 120 days, and so on and so on. Joe Biden could do this because the precedent has been set. You don't need the Senate confirmation based upon the workaround, essentially, that Jeff Sessions engaged in. So if it's that important, you could do that. Instead, they have decided to allow this judge in. Blue slips. Someone's asking for an explanation. It's just a Senate tradition that if you withhold your blue slip, and I don't even know if they actually have real blue slips anymore, but it's basically just signing off on the nomination of somebody who comes from your state. It's just, again, it's not a law. It's just a rule,
procedure,
a tradition,
yeah,
that they have followed. And the Republicans completely ignored them. And so now it's time for the Democrats to do that. So here's what folks should do. We're going to post in our description and the YouTube and the podcast description this following number, which is what, Bradley?
202-224-3121. That's the Capitol Hill switchboard.
202-224-3121. And call your senator and say no to Meredith. And everybody should just call Dick Durbin and say, ignore this nomination. Ignore it. Ignore it. There's absolutely no reason for it. The second correction I have. So, Emma?
Yeah, right. Well,
now we're
even about the Supreme Court leak debacle.
Well,
I don't want to hear another word about it ever again.
I'll update the scoreboard.
It hasn't been resolved quite yet, but we'll see. But so you were right. I was wrong. And then I have another correction to issue. Yesterday, I said after we watched the video of Josh Hawley with Professor
Kiara Bridges,
I suggested that Josh Hawley was going to be on Tucker Carlson last night, primetime Fox, to promote his attacking and getting into a fight with a black woman over the question of whether trans people exist. And he was going to, you know, march around like a peacock about it. And it turns out I was wrong. He did not go on Tucker Carlson last night. He went on Hannity. And so I apologize. I was wrong on that prediction. There must have been scheduling problems at Tucker.
Honestly, yeah.
And it's quite possible he may show up there tonight. So, again, I apologize.
Like Hannity trying to get it on the intellectual stuff.
Yeah. Hannity's really trying to make the move on that. He's trying to restake out his territory. So that is that. And let's go into... we're getting increasingly more information about the coup attempt. And Donald Trump, there was evidence that came out, a lot of evidence that Donald Trump knew they were going to go to the Capitol. So this whole idea, like, people got excited and they went, is BS. It gets worse. We'll be talking more about it later in the program. But here is John Bolton. John Bolton was so was such an extremist that a Republican-controlled Senate would not appoint him to be ambassador to the UN. He ended up getting it as an acting UN ambassador. Bush appointed him, I think, when the Senate was out of session at that time. But he was that extreme. At one point, he said, like, you could blow up half of the UN. Didn't matter. And, of course, he's on CNN commenting on and worked for Donald Trump until he didn't. And here he is poo-pooing the notion of a coup on January 6th. Not because there wasn't planning, not because that wasn't the intent, but using the old competent. Is it really a crime if they're incompetent when they try to commit it?
Not heed the advice and keep shopping around until you end up with this group of misfits with like Michael Flynn and Sidney Powell. Is he just not capable of hearing no?
Well, when it comes to his personal advantage, the answer is he doesn't listen to anybody else. But I think this, it's also important to understand, while nothing Donald Trump did after the election in connection with the lie about the election fraud, none of it is defensible. None of it is defensible. It's also a mistake, as some people have said, including on the committee, the commentators, that somehow this was a carefully planned coup d'etat aimed at the Constitution. That's not the way Donald Trump does things. It's rambling from one half-vast idea to another, one plan that
pause
falls
it for
through
one second,
and
pause
another.
Pause it for 1 second. I want you to just understand here what someone like John Bolton and somebody who has some type of legal training like he does, what he's doing when he says he is including multiple assertions within one sentence. It is not right to say that this is some carefully planned coup d'etat against the Constitution. Okay, now which part of that statement is exculpatory?
Mm.
Right? Like, does it have to be carefully planned? Like, what does it mean, carefully planned?
No, yeah.
Could it be just like a poorly planned coup d'etat against the Constitution? Or could it be a poorly planned coup d'etat, period? Like, you know, and so he combines all those things so that he doesn't have to defend each single premise there, but that one of those things, the qualifier, could negate the rest.
And notice that Republicans have now moved in the way that, like, they move from climate change isn't happening to, well, it's happening, but it's not man-made, and what can we do about it? They've moved from, there was no planning whatsoever, you can't control a mob of crazies, to, no, it's just poorly planned. Notice that.
It also makes me wonder what where, if there's any remote either involvement from him or associates, or if he's just, again, this is so much of this is about maintaining the Republican brand from being too tarred by Donald Trump. And the more you can make Donald Trump to be this rogue, operating individually, not involved in any type of like cohesive ideological project, the better for them. All right,
this is a Shapiro thing, too, though, where he says it's not defensible, but it is minimizable and downplayable.
Right, yeah. Right. When somebody says something's not defensible as opposed to it is reprehensible or it is illegal, that's what's going on here.
That would be too strong a language if he wants another job in a Republican administration.
Aimed at the Constitution. That's not the way Donald Trump does things. It's rambling from one half-vast idea to another. One plan that falls through and another comes up. That's what he was doing. As I say, none of it defensible. But you have to understand the nature of what the problem of Donald Trump is. He's, to use a Star Wars metaphor, a disturbance in the force. And it's not an attack on our democracy.
He's an anomaly.
It's Donald Trump looking out for Donald Trump. It's a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence.
I don't know that I agree with you, to be fair, with all due respect. One doesn't have to be brilliant to attempt a coup.
I disagree with that. As somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat,
yeah,
not here, but, you know, other places, it takes a lot of work. And that's not what he did. It was just stumbling around from one idea to another. Ultimately, he did unleash the rioters at the Capitol.
Pause as it, to that, pause it for there's one second. No. I mean, aside from Bolton being so incredibly self-impressed that he can't let it slip by because he knows that he has planned coups. He knows that he is brilliant in his mind.
But that's what this serves, right? It's self-serving. Like, coups are so intricate and difficult and sophisticated in their planning that this could not be done by the
group.
Which
is not true.
Right, it's not. Because he was involved.
Right.
But, like, it also feeds his own sense of self-importance to say, I know how coups are actually done.
But you look at the way the CIA, like, overthrew governments in, like, Guatemala and stuff. It's not like that. It's actually pretty rinky-dink.
Actually, they really just messed up in Venezuela, which he goes on to admit later. So no matter how smart you are in your coup planning, John Bolton, doesn't always go the right way.
And it also shows that how these people think, insofar as, like, you know, most people would think, like, certainly I would be, if someone had told me yesterday, hey, John Bolton's going to go on and admit and brag about doing coups as arguing that he is an expert in assessing whether a coup happened or not, because he's done a bunch of them. I'd be like, no way, because that would be, they don't think what they do is bad.
That's crazy.
And he's not confessing, bragging.
He's bragging. And
he feels resentment that he's not able to, in polite discourse, brag more often about this. Because this is his bread and butter.
Brags
and
all
coups
the time.
Are not, in the United States, that cannot happen here. Coups cannot happen here. Those are only things that our government orchestrates in other countries so we can exploit them more effectively. But here it's beyond the pale.
Continue.
Doubt, but not to overthrow the Constitution, to buy more time to throw the matter back to the states to try and redo the issue. And if you don't believe that, you're going to overreact.
All right, pause it. Okay, now pause it. Understand what he just said there. He's saying Trump was not trying to overthrow the Constitution. He was simply doing a mechanism to throw it back to the states and allow them to come back with different electors. And so now he's being like super, super, like, technical and hair-splitting as to whether this was an assault on the Constitution. And maybe it was not an assault on the letter of the Constitution. Maybe it was an assault on simply the spirit of the Constitution, which is supposed to be providing a change, a peaceful change of power that is not corrupt. But it doesn't say those words in the Constitution. So according to John Bolton, this was not an attack on the Constitution. It was just a way to sort of like sidestep the Constitution. All the constitutional things would be on paper. All the requirements would be met. It's just that we would do the corruption on a slightly lower level so that by the time it gets back to the Constitution, it'll look okay. Good.
Real risk for the committee, which has done a lot of good work, mostly when the witnesses testify, not when the members are opining. It is invariably the case that when you go too far trying to prove your case, you undermine it. And I think you got to give credit to the intelligence of the American people to listen to the witnesses and let them come to the conclusion. And I think the
as opposed
fellow
to my
who
just walking
gone
through
into the Capitol
the,
who said
the interpretation of how I want you to perceive the witnesses. But go ahead.
Today that he had blinders on and he was too loyal to one person. That is the central point.
Yeah. No, it's something. And it was, it, as I think.
Yeah.
OK,
sure.
Now let's go to the second clip, because the Tapper realizes and the producer says, hey, man, maybe you want to go back into that whole thing about the.
Follow up on that point.
The whole thing where he just admitted to committing coups.
So there's no follow-up, so we don't know which coups Bolton's taking credit for there. It's unclear which it is. I mean, he was probably active in efforts against Maduro in Venezuela.
He mentions that.
And that stuff is like, that's bumbling this to the next, like,
trying. But they
one
didn't
thing
admit
the
that it was a coup at the time, so that's why this is valuable.
I mean,
as
Murphy,
well.
Chris Murphy did.
Right.
Here's number two. Let's play this clip.
To anathematize the rest of the Republican Party, and that's unacceptable.
I do want to ask a follow-up. When we were talking about what is capable, what you need to do to be able to plan a coup, and you cited your expertise having planned coups.
I'm not going to get into the specifics, but...
Successful coups?
Well, I wrote about Venezuela in the book, and it turned out not to be successful. Not that we had all that much to do with it, but I saw what it took for an opposition to try and overturn an illegally elected president, and they failed. The notion that Donald Trump was...
Now, pause it for a second. Now, since we're in the world of being technical, getting rid of an illegal election is not a coup, is it? I mean... Is it a coup if you're getting rid of like an illegal election? You're just sort of like trying to reestablish constitutional rule.
It's the exact same term Trump is arguing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is, I mean, it's just him realizing like, shoot, that was supposed to be.
And by the way,
that was supposed to be clandestine. Damn it.
Right. And my bragging got in the way of it. Like, he went a little too far in his... Did you see that smug smile he had on his face? And when he was describing it... And by the way, the Biden administration holds that same line about Guaido in Venezuela. And they still talk about how Trump is this existential threat to democracy based on his claims about the election being stolen, etc. And yet they prop up the same kind of logic in Venezuela. Now, Trump is an existential threat, and what the Republicans tried to do on Jan 6 is. But you really can't parse that logic, frankly, and the entire like establishment is on board with it.
All right. We're going to get to Daniel Nakanian in just a second. A couple of words from our sponsors today. Folks, my breakfast and midnight snack favorite sponsoring the program today, Magic Spoon Cereal. It's got that sweet flavor and the crunchy texture you love from childhood. But here's the kicker. It's actually healthy. Yes. There are 0 grams of sugar. There are 13 to 14 grams of protein and only 4 or 5 net grams of carbs in each serving. It is low carb. It is keto friendly. It is gluten free, grain free, soy free, and only 140 calories a serving. But I will tell you this. When I do the taste test with the kids, they don't care about that. I care about that. They don't care about that. And I care about that when I eat it myself. You can now build your own box with a huge variety of flavors because you get these. They ship it to you. You can check out the classic flavors, the cocoa, the fruity, the frosted, and the peanut butter. The cult faves, blueberry muffin, maple waffle, and honey nut. The indulgent ones, cookie and cream, and cinnamon roll. All of those, folks. I got to say, this is going to come as a surprise, but the honey nut for me has been my go-to.
Oh, wow. It? That's a real change.
It is a change. But it is, cereals are delicious, and you don't feel like you're eating crap. I don't know how they do it. I think it's like, what was it, monk fruit extract or something to sweeten it? I'm not exactly sure. But check it out. You're going to love this. And you can get all fruity if you want, or you can get all cocoa, or you can get the... Mixing the cocoa and the peanut butter, though, don't sleep on that. Go to magicspoon.com/majorityreport. Grab a custom bundle of cereal. Try the magic for yourself. And be sure to use our promo code MajorityReport. Use it at checkout. You'll save $5 off your order. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, you can get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/majorityreport. Use the code MajorityReport to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode, my breakfast. And I guess it wasn't last night. It was two nights ago. I had a little
midnight
bit of
snack.
Well, it was actually a 4 a.m. snack, but
okay.
Whatever.
What kind of milk do you use?
What?
What kind of milk do you use?
Just whole milk.
I'm a 2% guy.
Me too.
All right. Suit yourself. One of our favorite sponsors, Sunset Lake Sabade sunsetlake.com, sunsetlake, sebade.com. As you know, if you use the classic code, left is best, you get 20% off. But right now, for this week only, until Monday night at 11:59 p.m., all of their sebade tinctures will be 35% off with the coupon code tincture. Sunset Lake sebade has a wide variety of sebade tinctures. There's something for everybody. If you need help getting to sleep, try their sebade melatonin tincture before bed for a better night's sleep. Sunset Lake sebade high potency 3,000 and 6,000 milligram tinctures are perfect for catching a mellow buzz, reducing stress after a long day at work. Much better way, frankly, healthier way to relax than drinking alcohol, in my estimation. But and starting 2 days ago, all sebade tinctures are going to be 35% off. Use the coupon code tincture. For me, it has been my go-to sleep aid for years now. And they have flavored versions, natural, citrus, and mint. The mint one I mentioned the other day, I use at night. Doesn't clash my toothpaste. I know that sounds a little bit weird.
No, no.
It's just the way it is.
Michael would be making fun of you at this point.
Exactly. And there are times where, I'm not going to lie, it's helped with my parenting. Sometimes the kids can get a little aggravating. Also, the cats can get a little aggravating. One of them is just constantly hungry. And then I got to give them shots. It drives me crazy. And as soon as I feel myself getting a little bit riled up, I walk over, take a little pincher, and it helps. Sunset Lake Sebade is a majority employee-owned business. They have donated more than $26,000 last year to anti-drug war organizations, to animal shelters, union strike funds, nature conservation, food pantries, refugee resettlement organizations, the Innocence Project, I mean, on and on. They're movement partners, folks. Great company. And again, all of their stuff, third-party analyzed. You can find it on their website. So all sebade tinctures will be 35% off with the coupon code tincture until next Monday night. Visit sunsetlakesebade.com. Try these amazing products. Take advantage of the sale while it lasts, folks. Great, great opportunity for you to try a bunch of new stuff. Sale ends July 18th. All right. Want to welcome back to the program Daniel Nakanian, editor-in-chief of Bolts Magazine. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be with him in a sec. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us, Daniel Nakanian. He is the editor-in-chief of Bolt Magazine. Can't encourage folks enough to go over there, sign up, and follow both on Twitter and, of course, the stuff that you guys are writing. Daniel, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
All right. So, Daniel, you are the guy that I read, whether it's on Twitter or Bolt Magazine, to get a sense of key races, all sorts of races around the country relative to criminal justice reform, relative to immigration enforcement and relationship between sheriffs and immigration services. You have done the same for key races in the wake of Roe v. Wade. And I want to talk about those. I know you got a lot of other things that you're watching, too, and maybe we have time on those. But let's go through some of these, because there is such divergence among the states right now. I think we have 10 to 13 states. I don't know if we have all 13 who had trigger laws that have gone into effect. You'd probably know better than I. And then another 13 we're anticipating are going to have some ban on abortion, major ban on abortion, maybe some exemptions, maybe not. But within those states, there are divergences or attempts by various players to perhaps mitigate the impact of these bans. So let's go through these. I'm just going to go through the order that you had in a Twitter thread, unless you think that there's some that are more important than others that you want to talk about, having gone through that.
Maybe just let me introduce it by, you know, saying that we're really used to thinking about this as a federal issue, right? And the whole point right now is that the Supreme Court has made it non-federal. And there's just it's very important for people to think about flexibly about just the huge array of officials we're talking about that now have a say on whether people in the country get to use their reproductive rights. And if they do, whether they'll face criminal charges or criminal consequence, right? And it's really important to sort of think expansively and about everyone who's sort of involved in that. And yeah, if you want, I think the whole order of the thread is just kind of a window for people to kind of start thinking about the important hotspots, but also what their own officials are doing with this. And I invite everyone to sort of start to think about their judges, their prosecutor, their governor, their lawmaker, their sheriff, their police officer, their mayor, and, you know, we could go on about the role of each of these people and whether or not they will facilitate the criminalization of abortion or not.
I mean, it's interesting because I think that, you know, the key, particularly when you talk about what the implications of the criminalization are going to be, it seems to me the audience for that are abortion care providers and the lawyers that love them, essentially, right? I mean, the hospital lawyers, because they need to know that the local DA or the governor or the state's attorney general is not going to bring charges against them, and whether there are maybe judges who are not or courts are not amenable to lawsuits that are brought based upon these prohibitions. And so these are really important. Let's just start with you start with Maricopa, the Maricopa prosecutor. Why the Maricopa County prosecutor?
Yeah, that was an obvious one to start with to me, because it captured for so many reasons why, like, the kind of crux of where we're at. One, Maricopa County, for people who don't know, is one of the biggest counties in the nation. I think the third or fourth. It has 4.5 million people. So in and of itself, the idea that one local official, county official, can impact has jurisdiction over millions of people.
Is 4.5 million people. This is in, right, we should say, in Arizona too, yes, where, you know, the governorship is maybe a little bit is up in the air too, right?
Definitely. So Arizona has a lot in flux right now. For anyone in Arizona, you're going to decide a lot. And this county, which is home to Phoenix and other large cities, is home to the majority of Arizona's population. It's sort of this situation where the county officials are covering most of the population. The prosecutor there, you might actually, like, people who are watching might actually remember, even if they're not there, because she was chosen by Senate Republicans in D.C. to lead the questioning of Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Ford back in 2018. You know, that's when Republicans didn't want to take it upon themselves to interrogate Ford and Kavanaugh during proceedings. So they called upon this prosecutor from Arizona, who has since become the chief prosecutor of the county. And she now that Kavanaugh, obviously, as we all know, was confirmed and voted with the majority in Dobbs, the decision effectively gave Prosecutor Mitchell, I'm blanking on her first name for a second, the power to prosecute abortion. There's some legal flux around the status of the existing bans in Arizona. So at the moment, it is not kicked into place. But she has said that she will enforce the law, that she would be open to prosecuting abortions once those laws are into effect. The opponent that she's facing, and Meg O'Connor did a great story for Bolton and the appeal on this, which is linked in the thread, has said the Democratic opponent in November has taken the exact opposite position, has said she will never prosecute any cases linked to abortion in Maricopa County. So that in and of itself, the decision of this prosecutor covering $4.5 million, if she were to win, would change the landscape of criminalization in this huge county. And, you know, it's important for people who live there. But again, just the way in which it can help us start thinking about what's happening elsewhere in the country, the connection between executive power at the county level and the ramifications of it are huge there, but really are a microcosm of what's going to happen in a lot of places.
Could the state attorney general step in and charge someone?
Great question. So states are very different in terms of whether the jurisdiction to prosecute is shared. And Arizona, as you know, Meg sort of looked into in the article, there might be ways for Republicans to try and get creative about the powers of the AG there, but there is no easy way for the AG to necessarily get involved and try to supersede the authority prosecutor. So that is a particularly important one where there's quite a bit of discretion. Elsewhere in Michigan, in Texas, we're seeing efforts to create more jurisdiction. Republicans are probably going to step up where they can. But, you know, we're talking about the AG office isn't necessarily equipped to handle a ton of cases out of nowhere at the county level. This is all like uncharted territory. Like, prosecutors are used to having immense discretion, and it's very rare for other people to step in their fiefdoms, you know. And that's, you know, I think we've talked about that before, but it's only like now that the discretion is being used in a direction that's favorable to progress, right, that suddenly conservatives are freaking out about the scope of prosecutor discretion, with which they had no problem when it led to mass incarceration.
Right. I mean, this is there has been a massive role reversal in the wake of this. You know, in the past, it was Roe is still stands in this state, whatever state you want to choose, a hypothetical state. However, we have made it so difficult on a practical level that there is virtually no accessibility for abortion. Now, what is happening is there's a ban on abortion in this state. However, we are now on a practical level making that meaningless by defanging the apparatus in which to punish people if they do get an abortion.
It's because you brought up the point about clinics earlier, and obviously a lot of it is about providers, right? And to some degree, given insurance and the lawyers you mentioned, the question of whether clinics can stay open just because a prosecutor said something that's a stretch, because the liability, the risk is still huge. But, you know, there's so much other risks that people can face. You know, abortions are going to continue even if they're not legal. And the risk of people who get abortions is also high. There was, and if we could get it's further down in the thread, but there was a DA in California in recent years, again, blue California, where abortion is legal, who prosecuted two women for murder after they had stillbirth. And it took a while for that to sort of become a buzz in California. The AG tried to get involved. The DA faced a lot of pressure and actually lost his election a month ago in a conservative part of California to an opponent who took issue with those prosecutions and said and actually went to protests against them locally. So that's, again, that's in California. Again, an invitation to think about what's happening in your own corner of the country. But it's not just like a question of clinics are open or not. You know, abortion, like, there's going to be a lot of people who face criminal threats for the choices that they're going to make in a lot of places in the coming years.
Let's go to Pennsylvania. In this instance, it is there's a big election for governor.
Yeah.
The Senate race seems to be going fairly well for Fetterman. He's, you know, it's nice to be able to run against someone like Dr. Oz.
who doesn't even live in the state and is like filming his ads from his mansion in New Jersey.
I mean, you know, it's a little bit inconvenient to have to cross state lines to film. We've got an election happening. Wolf has to step down. There's a term limit in Pennsylvania, and Shapiro is running. And why is this race important relative to Roe v. Wade?
Right. Well, that election has gotten a lot of press because the Republican nominee is arguably the most extreme Republican nominee in the country right now, in terms of the entanglement with January 6th, with that, you know, the threats to democracy. And
he's also a full-on theocrat, it really appears, too.
I mean, he's also, I mean, but just taking a step back, the reason that that matters is that Republicans in the state, broadly, independently of him, would be interested in adopting new restrictions on abortion. Obviously, how far they go remains to be seen. But the thing that is right now standing in the way in Pennsylvania, a major swing state with a lot of suburban areas that are meant to be favorable to abortion rights, the only thing that really stands between Pennsylvania joining some of the other states we're talking about is the governor. And the governor right now is a Democrat who has veto power. That governor cannot run for re-election in November. That one is very simple, right? The state assembly and House and Senate are Republican. They're interested in anti-abortion bills. If the governor is someone in line with them, and he would be if the Republican nominee wins, then Pennsylvania will take very, very big steps in against abortion access. That probably, I think, in some ways, is the cleanest governor's race in terms of explaining the stakes, because of the Republican majorities and the veto power situation. You know, there's all others I could flag, but it is not about the extreme quality of the Republican nominee there. It's just the platform of the party, right?
Right. Right. And there's two points I want to make here. One is, you started this thread, you said, with the caveat that the next steps need to involve mobilization, solidarity, and protests that aren't electorally focused. And then you went on to talk about, you know, because mobilizing, solidarity, and protests, I think, aren't necessarily surgical and don't, you know, I think they're important all across the country in every area, and everybody can do this in that moment. But let me ask you this general question, because we're only going to hit like two or three more of these.
Right.
Is there a person, a candidate in this country who is a Republican that you could vote for and it would increase or protect abortion rights anywhere in this entire country, in any race? And you literally have a spreadsheet of just about every possible race in the country. Is there one where there is a Republican running where, if you elect that person, you're going to protect or increase people's access to abortion?
Putting me on the spot. I think to not overstate what I'm saying at all, there definitely are Republicans in places like Vermont or Maryland who aren't opposed to abortion rights and opposed to abortion access. And where, I was trying to be careful. The reason I wanted to kind of caveat the threat as I did and be careful about this is that there's a lot of exhortations to vote, right? And like, vote, period. And that seems very, that seems very, first of all, it seems kind of trite, but also unrelated to the stakes. People really want to know, wait, what, like, obviously we all know that the Democrats have a majority in the Senate, in the U.S. Senate, and that's not enough right now for protecting any of this. So being able to connect the dots, and in that sense, it's not just a matter of them versus GOP as proxy, but trying to be specific in the stakes and the threat. So in that sense, there are elections where this is not as central a stake if Republicans are
right. I mean, there's elections where you have a Republican who may be pro-choice and a Democrat who's pro-choice.
I'm not thinking of an election where the roles are inverted. I think there's definitely pro-life Democrats. I mean, probably a lot of people who are following the primary in Texas, congressional primary. I mean, others, like in states like Rhode Island or New Jersey, where Democrats have a lot of power, there's actually a fairly strong pro-life Democratic contingent. So that is playing out within the primary. But I think if you're in states like that where you think Democrats are strongly in power, I mean, again, it's important to check out whether that means that people who are pro-choice and want to codify that are in power. I'm hard pressed to think of the situation where it's literally inverted. In the way you are.
Okay, Judge, that to ask, it just occurred to me.
Like, yeah.
You know, I mean, which is, you know, and the value of these of you breaking it down this way is also, you know, people want to deploy their resources, or maybe they know somebody, you know, who lives in one of these places, and they could say, like, here's another reason for you to get out there and get involved in this stuff. Obviously. Reasons to get to protest and to organize and to develop some solidarity and whatnot are pretty consistent. Let's talk about the Michigan Attorney General's race. Michigan is also another hotspot, and I guess it's no coincidence that we're also talking about states that are often battleground states when we're talking about a presidential election, and frankly. You know,
and
to
ones
some extent,
that can
Senate.
Trend blue, and one right. Well, particularly, go on, Daniel. I didn't want to cut you off.
No. Absolutely, Michigan. Actually, the threat is a couple of weeks old. The news in Michigan that you may have that happened yesterday is that organizers submitted more than 500,000.
750,000 or something like that. Number.
Enough signatures to put a constitutional amendment on a ballot that would codify abortion rights. That could pass or not, but that kind of trumps, in terms of importance, that sort of suddenly trumps the importance of the rest, because that would sort of offset a lot of the other ways to mitigate the harm of the current ban on abortion in Michigan that is pre-Roe, and that is currently under court litigation, which itself is something to pay attention to, because the court is on the ballot this fall. So Michigan is just sort of, I mean, as much like the governor's race, the AG race, the referendum, the Supreme Court race. I mean, the abortion access in Michigan is on the ballot this year, and probably in more ways than in any other states. And the ballot initiative passing would first qualifying and then passing would definitely be the biggest deal. And if that were to not qualify or pass, the AG race, for instance, maybe that's a good example to go back to your earlier question for people to understand sort of the complexity here, is that the Michigan Attorney General has the power to step in a county if the prosecutor is not criminally charging. The AG can step in and be like, I'm intervening. And, you know, there are actually a lot of Michigan prosecutors who have said they will not press charges. And I was talking to the prosecutor in Ann Arbor a few weeks ago, who was explaining his decision, saying we would have blood on our hands if we weren't to do that. But he also was honest about the limits in Michigan of prosecutor discretion. And right now the AG there is a Democrat. If it were to flip and the Republican were to win with an anti-abortion agenda, that definitely would affect it would affect a lot of people who live in bluer areas of the state.
We should also say that, like, you know, this is also not just about, you know, electoral. This is about seeing where there are sort of weak links or potential opportunities for people who are organizing and protesting different sort of, I guess, pressure points within the system that are effective. All right, let's talk about two broadly two more in your tweet thread. One is you got a situation like Texas. I mean, you mentioned Kansas has a referendum, whether to adopt a constitutional amendment that would overturn a state court ruling that is protecting abortion rights. That's pretty straightforward, right? I mean, you want to vote against a constitutional amendment to ban abortion. In Texas, you've got, and this is playing out also in different places around the country, you've got a DA who's not going to prosecute cases. And again, this is another situation where red state may have a different dynamic than, Arizona. But this is going to be important, right? I mean, around the state. And I would imagine if there's a DA on the fence, should I or should I not, they see another DA doing it. And that combined with pressure of in the public, that could sway another DA's decision.
I mean, what is interesting is that one thing about the pressure point, I think often it feels like the left of center side isn't very organized at the local and state level. On prosecutors, they have been effort for months to create the sort of mutual help that you're describing, to create lists of people who are co-signing these letters, who are going in it together, to not feel like suddenly on their own being like, we're not going to enforce these laws, to speak the same language. And Texas is a great example of there being, I forget the number, but already in the spring, there were 4 and 5 of the biggest DAs in Austin and Dallas and San Antonio who released a joint statement taking a joint position on this. Not everyone, but now some of them are on the ballot. Some of them might. Some people are running with different positions, and that's interesting to see that level of organization on this issue, at least on the prosecutor front, to try and think this through. The risk, again, is that it's gonna, in Texas, I think it's particularly clear more than other states, that it's gonna provoke a response by conservatives who will have probably the authority next year to try and find ways to try and find ways around it.
And then lastly, let's talk about this. It's just another level of this. There are 4 states, Ohio, North Carolina, Illinois, and Michigan, where you could theoretically flip the majority of essentially partisanship on the state Supreme Court. And that, of course, has a huge impact on whether a state's abortion ban is found constitutional within the context of their state, or whether certain, a whole host of issues will go through these state Supreme Courts. And they are much more nakedly, I don't know how to put this, they're much more, everyone feels much more comfortable understanding the partisan nature of these state Supreme Courts because they're elected, as opposed to the partisan nature of our federal Supreme Court, because it's supposedly appointed and it's shielded from that. But in these states, this is the name of the game. It is, we are electing almost like a miniature state assembly.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, I can't overstate how important these are. They're so in terms of how undercovered something important is, we can't think of anything else. You mentioned Kansas a second ago. It's a red state. It's a conservative state. It has protected the right to abortion right now because of the state Supreme Court that decided that the Equal Protection Clause, I think that's the clause in Kansas, the clause of the state constitution protects abortion, and that is under threat now from another route, but that is a state Supreme Court decision. And the 4 states you said, Ohio, North Carolina, Illinois, and Michigan are the states where the partisan majority might flip, but there are other places like Arkansas and Montana, where we're seeing right now conservatives trying to oust incumbent justices with conservative platforms, and those are the places that state claims are going to go. Those are courts that could protect abortion rights, even in red states. Those are courts that even in places that don't have bans could strike down restrictions. The Florida Supreme Court is huge right now because Florida actually has a somewhat protective regime, but the governor has had a huge hand in completely shifting the court's politics over the past few years, and it's going to completely change the abortion access in Florida. You know, and I know, to finish, because we're like throwing around a lot of different institutions and offices here, but I think that's the point, right? The point is that there's no like solution here. There's no like one thing that's gonna like, well, there are federal solutions, but at the state level, there's nothing that's like a silver bullet, but there's so many different institutions, so many levers of power that have more room to do much more if they're invested with like more creativity and imagination about what these offices should be doing and could be doing.
Well, Daniel, that's why I think what you do is so invaluable, frankly. Really appreciate it. And folks can follow you. We'll put your Twitter handle up there, and folks check out Bulge Magazine. We'll put links to that as well. Daniel Nakanian, always a pleasure and always really enlightening. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Lupe Rodriguez. She is the executive director for the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Justice, and we will talk about the activism that we hopefully will see in the coming weeks, months, years, I guess, involving this issue. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Like to welcome, I don't know if you've been on this show, but I think Emma has interviewed you for our old second hour Peacock show.
Good to see you again.
Lupe Rodriguez, the executive director for the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Justice. Give us a sense of, I mean, I think most people, maybe not so much the administration for whatever reason, was anticipating this decision at the very least since the leak. But really, I think organizations like yours have known this is on the horizon. The moment that Amy Coney Barrett was I think nominated and confirmed, and maybe even before that. What have you been doing in the build up to this, or I guess in anticipation? Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, and nice to see you again, Emma. This was absolutely not a surprise for many of us who've been in this movement for a very long time, and particularly for organizations like mine that have been doing work in the reproductive justice space. We know that for a long time, the courts and legislatures at the state level and at the federal level have never really guaranteed the right to abortion for communities of color and Black, Latina, Latinx, API, LGBTQ communities. This was the continuation of an erosion of rights that we've seen ongoing for many, many years. So what we've been trying to do for a long time is in the buildup to this, even decades before this, is fight back against the kinds of like policies that have been the law of the land, and really honestly like long-term sort of vision about like how to build power in our communities to fight back. And it's something that's serving us in this moment, honestly, because we saw this coming. We've been fighting against the status quo for a long time, and all of the work that we've been doing is has prepared us for what we're facing right now.
Before we talk about specifically what kind of power you are building in these communities, for some folks it may be just sort of remedial, but for others I think they may not fully understand this dynamic. When you say that the right to an abortion has been inhibited prior to the reversal of Roe v. Wade, particularly for women of color and LGBTQ folks and broadly marginalized folks in our society, what are we talking about? Like why?
Well, we're talking about things like the Hyde Amendment, which was a law that was passed 3 years after Roe versus Wade was the decision came down in 1973. So this was passed in 1976, which is a federal ban on funding for abortions. And that has created barriers for people of color, low income people across the country for you know, since Roe versus Wade has existed. And so there's that. There's also been the chipping away of rights in different states with restrictions that have existed for a long time, like parental notification laws, like laws that make it so that folks had to wait 72 hours before getting an abortion. So like waiting periods, misleading information that the doctors were forced to give people. So, you know, telling people that abortion causes cancer, things like that, right? Like medically inaccurate information. And then just like other restrictions that have made it so that, for example, in Mississippi, even before Roe versus Wade decision came down, this year, there was one clinic in the entire state of Mississippi. Even in places like California, where 40% of the counties in the state don't have an abortion provider because it's just not affordable to do that, to provide that care. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, across the country, there have been these barriers that have existed for people for many, many years, for a long time, and that have kept folks from being able to get the care they need if they don't have the resources to get it. It's just been hard for a long time.
And this is, I mean, we're talking about essentially the intersection, if you will, of low income folks, mm-hmm. and in some instances it's a question sheerly specifically of geography, but it's also mm-hmm. largely a question of class, right? I mean, of economic class here that we're talking about. And it's I think it's easier for people to conceive of the idea that Medicaid would say, yeah, we're not covering births. Like, we're just not going to cover births. Mm-hmm. we're not going to cover certain types of cancer. We just, like, if you get breast cancer, that's one thing that we're just cutting out. And I think people, it would be easier for people to sort of like appreciate at that point, like, that's absurd and bizarre. But because of the framing, I think, of abortion, it doesn't fully made clear to people just how this is an attack on low income women and people who have uteruses, essentially.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's an attack on pregnant people, right? Anybody who can be pregnant. And absolutely it's really based on economics and undercutting folks who have already been marginalized by other systems in our society. And sadly, you know, that it ties into like the white supremacist systems that we exist in this country that really make it so that communities of color are those who largely are lower income and who lack access. I think the maternal mortality rate in this country is demonstrative of the fact that like we have not just with respect to abortion, but we have other systems that are failing our communities in terms of providing like adequate healthcare access and other resources for us to thrive and live healthy lives.
What's your organization and some of your colleagues, what are the preparations that you are undergoing for when women are likely, I think, by maybe some sort of aggressive district attorney mm-hmm. or law enforcement, targeted, particularly low-income women, for seeking abortions if they are not, if local law enforcement deems that they are doing drugs or that they are a miscarriage is the fault of a woman? There's just this whole chain of reactions that could result from this where women are targeted criminally. What are some of the preparations that you're undergoing to prepare for that?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, we've been kind of foreseeing this and have been doing a lot of work for a long time to support folks in training and, knowing their rights. I think that's like the basic thing around this, that in the aftermath of the decision, we've been really active in connecting with folks around education about what their rights are, what the actual laws are, and providing that information in the language that of their choice and the language they speak, because I think that's another thing that we're seeing is missing. Where folks who might not speak English are not getting the accurate information. So we're doing things like that. We're connecting with folks, folks with resources and networks that exist right now that are supporting with criminalization and the potential for that. The network, the of lawyers at If When How is an organization that's doing a lot of work to look at, you know, all of the different laws that are going on right now, like where there's the potential for criminalization and how to support people. There's a legal defense fund that's part of that work, and there's a bail fund. So you know, we've been preparing and building those resources to be able to support people with that. And then, of course, you know, we're asking the administration, our elected officials right now, to think about enacting and moving things forward to support or to prevent the criminalization that we think may happen or will happen, and are really holding them accountable to us to, you know, to ensure that doesn't happen in different states.
And
that protection at the federal level, if they can.
You said earlier that you were working on building power in these communities. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you go about doing that, and how does it manifest itself, and what kind of things do are folks doing?
Well, you know, for example, in Texas, the Latina Institute has been working there for 15 years in the Rio Grande Valley, southern Texas, and building a network of what we call poderosas, who are activists, who are, you know, they're trained in rapid response to support community members if they need anything. They're trained in advocacy and policy advocacy. They're trained on, you know, running for office and you know, organizing work. In fact, our state leader in Texas was originally one of our poderosas 13 years ago, who's now leading our state efforts in Texas. And so that's the kind of work that we want to do, that we're doing in Texas, in Florida, in Virginia, in New York. But we're looking to expand to other parts of the country, really, to be able to, you know, our goal here is to train folks to be able to deconstruct and really, you know, recreate the power structures that have gotten us to these places where we are. We know that's long term, I think, the way that we get to real justice.
Is there any is your organization engaged in any type of, like, I guess, more short term and midterm work in terms of, like, providing material means in which to get access to abortion? I mean, a lot of this stuff now is going to become, you know, particularly in some of these states, is almost like gray market mm-hmm. type of stuff, I guess.
Definitely. We are working to connect people to resources. So we're not an abortion fund, and we don't mean to sort of recreate ourselves in that light, but we're working really closely with abortion funds across the country to get people to them, to get them resources. We're working to ensure that there's, like, accurate information. Like, that's one of our lanes right now. We do a lot of work, you know, just around, like, you know, making sure that folks know what their rights are, where to get the resources to get the care they need. And we do so in, you know, in Spanish, so that, because we know that that's missing, that's a missing piece right now. And we're also looking at, you know, working on mobilizations, like engaging folks on the ground, thinking about the elections. We do a lot of civic engagement work and voter engagement work. So we're looking toward the elections. And then we're also just, you know, kind of continuing the work that we've always done. We really feel strongly that, like, veering away to do other work right now is not the way forward. We're doubling down on the investment that we have in the communities where we have been building power, and really thinking about how we can build these same kind of reproductive justice organizing spaces in other parts of the country, where we know, you know, people are and are upset about this and want to take action. So we're really trying to, you know, harness all of that power that we're seeing coming out of the community and in anger at what's happening.
Is any of that, or is there, I mean, do you folks, has there been any attempts to tie in the community's power via sort of the labor movement? Mm-hmm. Or maybe, I don't know necessarily through unions, but just a consciousness that, you know, much of the power that a lot of these folks have is probably tied into, or at least broadly in the community, is tied into their labor.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that we operate by, operate through the lens of the reproductive justice movement is that, you know, there are intersectional movements that all connect around these issues. And so absolutely, you know, part of the training and the work that we do with folks in our Poderosa network, you know, is about like organizing their workplaces, like working, you know, and in coalition with organizations like labor organizations, economic justice organizations of various kinds, immigrant rights organizations, and other folks that, you know, that are part of the experience of the people that we work with, right? Like we recognize that abortion is not the only issue that's on people's minds. And we're working really closely to make the connection with our allies in labor and other movements around how abortion is central to a person's ability to make economic choices for themselves and their families, right? And really kind of working to make those connections. So yeah, absolutely. I think that we're all tied together in this.
Lupe Rodriguez, Executive Director for the National Latina Institute of Reproductive for Reproductive Justice. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to your organization and really appreciate it.
Thank you both.
All right, folks. I'm going to head into the fun half of the program. Number 646-257-3920. And you can join us there. You can also IM the program by picking up the app at majorityapp.com. And don't forget, it is your support that makes this show possible. Become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help the show survive and thrive, but you also get the free show, free of commercials. And keep the Saturday in there this week, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
Special discount for that tincture. But generally, you get the free show, free of commercials, and you get the fun half. So check that out. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Matt, it's happening in the Matt Lekian Media Universe.
Yeah, excited about the show tonight. Marcus from Left Flank Vets is going to come on and talk to us about his journey from to the military to left media and some other stuff. We'll also be talking about Elon versus Trump, and I'll probably be getting pretty pissed over some of the anti-trans stuff. So tune in tonight, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get our full post game.
Really hate to see this breakup between Elon and Trump.
I don't. I thought
you were going to get me back on Twitter.
What was his
Twitter
social...
in response to the Elon thing should ban Elon and put Trump back on.
Honestly, like they were responding to his tweet, and I'm like, I'll tell you how you respond to his tweet. Block.
Ban him.
Yeah. Block. Full on block. All right, folks. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun. Nomi Keen.
You did it!
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon!
Fun. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7-8?
Yes.
Me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go throw up.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3551. One half. 3 8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400, $1,900.
$6.543 trillion sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this. Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we seen you. All right, folks.
It's just the wheat being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.